Rod's Pulse Podcast number 56. Interview. Peter Vantinen on Aquila and PodSafe New Age.
This is Rod's Pulse Podcast, the podcast for faculty and students interested in learning how to use and create podcasts and other e-learning technologies. Welcome back.
Hi, this is Rod. Welcome back. That was some New Age music by a group called Falling You. That piece was called Something About Eve, and you can hear the full song at the end of my podcast. Just as a reminder, I got this from one of my two sources for PodSafe music. I got it from Magnatune.com, and they have a very unique business plan. You can actually buy a CD. You can download it, or they will ship it to you. And they encourage you to share it with two of your friends. So, and you can even pick how much you want to pay for the CD. I think the minimum is probably $5 for a full CD. But check it out, magnatune.com, and stay tuned at the end of the podcast for the full song. I took about a week off. I had a string of about three podcasts dealing with National Distance Learning Week. I hope you took part in some of the activities, and hope your school did too. So now I'm going back to more of my regular schedule. First today, I'd like to give you some news from the Podosphere, and then I'll continue with my main topic today, which is an interview with Peter Vantinen. First, news from the Podosphere. Amazon announced their first hardware product to read books. It's called Kindle. I haven't seen it, but I did note that it was in the news quite a bit. And I sometimes read a blog by Guy Kawasaki. He's one of the evangelists. I think his title with Apple Computer originally was Chief Evangelist. He has a pretty interesting blog, and he talked about the Amazon Kindle. And it's a pretty unique device. There have been other attempts in the past to have an electronic book reader. Sony has a device out. Generally speaking, they're kind of heavy, expensive, and battery doesn't last too long. He seemed to really like it. One of the interesting features gives you a taste for the future and where you don't need a computer to have an electronic book. No computer is required. It runs on a wireless system. You don't pay by the throughput, so you're not paying an arm and a leg for wireless service, but you go to the website, purchase a book, and it's downloaded while you're sleeping or whenever. I guess the Kindle is idling. So they push out content to you, and some magazines, for example, and books. They have a deal with the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, Fortune, Time, Atlantic Monthly. So not only can you read books and subscribe to newspapers, you can also subscribe to some blogs. So battery life is very good. And the screen is quite readable. That's been a problem in the past. Something that you might be surprised about is that it's not a backlit screen. That's because it's a new technology. It's electronic paper technology. The beauty is you can read it in bright sunlight. You don't have to worry about having a backlight. And it therefore draws less current and can extend the life of the battery. It does come with a little book light so that if you do want to read it in bed in the semi-darkness, you can turn on the book light. So it'll take some time before the jury is in whether people start using this instead of buying hardback books. But I can imagine in the educational environment, this might be a real slick solution for schools if they can make deals with publishers and have those fat textbooks be distributed on a book reader such as the Kindle. Anyway, I thought you might be interested in that. I have a link to the Guy Kawasaki's blog on my website. As usual, at www.rodspulsepodcast.com. The second bit of news from the Podosphere was a report that I noticed from my reading of EDUCAUSE. It was a presentation given at the recent meeting, and it had to do with podcasting, and I bring it to your attention because it's somewhat unique in that they're using Facebook in an educational environment. So what this particular faculty member did, using some of the typical tools we've been talking about, I think they use WordPress instead of Blogger, but they use FeedBurner for the feed. So the instructor created a Facebook group that he put up, he used to put up the class assignments and materials for the course. So they were distributed through the group and through the blog. And audio recordings were also linked from the blog. So it's an interesting idea. Certainly if you have something like Blackboard at your disposal, if your school uses Blackboard, some other course management system, this might not be the way to go. But on the other hand, it might be interesting to capture some freshman students, especially as what he was dealing with, who have already in Facebook and spent a lot of their time there. Might be a way to distribute educational content. I should have said the faculty, that person that did this, is Peter Juvenal from Illinois State University College of Business, and it was a freshman course. One thing that he pointed out, which I read about again and again, is that, and it may be surprising to many faculty, is that the project using podcasting did not detract from attendance. At no point did podcasting result in a significant drop in attendance, and I see that again and again. So that's somewhat reassuring. Okay, now on to my main topic for today. I've known Peter Van Tienen for quite a few years. He was an engineer with Blackboard, our course management system at Thomas Jefferson. He has left Blackboard and is now the Vice President of Business Development at a company called Learning Edge North America. Their main product is Equella. It's a digital repository that incorporates learning objects, learning content management, integrated content authoring, and I have a link to their website on my show notes. It's www.equella.com. So here we go. Here's my interview with Peter Van Tienen. Peter, thanks for joining me today on my podcast.
You're very welcome. It's been too long.
Yeah. Of course, we first knew each other when you were with Blackboard. Can you tell me what you've been doing since then?
I can. I have moved on from Blackboard about a year and a half ago. And since then, I met a small company out of Hobart, Australia, called The Learning Edge, and was asked to come on board and lead their efforts into expansion into North America. And we already had some really good success in the region, and so I've just been sort of helping to grow that business here.
I'm afraid I couldn't go to the recent EDUCAUSE meeting, and I know you were there. And I notice on your email it says Equella. Now, I looked briefly at your website, but it was a little mysterious to me. How can you describe Equella and what it does for educators?
Sure. So the company is called The Learning Edge, based in Australia. In North America, we're known as The Learning Edge North America. And our product or platform is called Equella, which is a digital repository or learning object repository or learning content management system, depending on how you would like to term it. So we are a content management platform. We can handle pretty much any type of learning content, from standard PowerPoint presentations to full online video to IMS and SCORM packages to any type of content that you want to put into a repository. We can share it, manage it, tag it, store it, search it, and even control digital rights and copyright controls around that content.
I see. What would this be something that you would be an add-on to a course management system like Blackboard?
It could very well be, yes. So we have our own standalone interface. It's all browser-based. But one of the strengths of Equella is the fact that not only can we integrate with a system like Blackboard, we can integrate with all of the major course management systems, and we can integrate with them at the same time. And so a lot of what we're doing here in North America is not only powering single institutions, but we're powering entire statewide initiatives for repositories. We are currently the repository for the entire state of Florida through the Florida Distance Learning Consortia, enabling content sharing across institutions. We're doing the similar in Georgia with the Georgia Board of Regents. Just started a project off with the North Carolina Community College System, And so, you know, our value is that we can enable content sharing and management across all of these course management platforms.
I see. So a faculty person would be able to go in there and have tools to enter their own content, you know, for learning. How would that differ, though? How would that experience differ from, say, just going into native Blackboard and adding content?
So there's a couple of ways. One is that we know that it's very important and able to be able to share content. You have to be able to tag it appropriately so that I can find that content. And so in a sort of Google world, we can do keyword searching. But what's important is that when a faculty is contributing content to any content sharing area, they can describe it in a way that makes sense for other people to be able to find it. We use a method that we call contribution wizards, which are highly configurable wizard interfaces that faculty then just simply fill in a bunch of questions. And so we can ask them simple questions like title, description, and keyword, or it can be very complex, like tying it directly to learning outcomes and learning objectives using what we call taxonomy browsers to find and tag that content. So it's very easy for our faculty to put the content in. We can do things like ask them questions, is it considered best practice? If it is, kick off a workflow to get peer evaluation, peer review. We can ask them where they'd like to share it, you know, and if they'd like to share that worldwide, then we can wrap it around Creative Commons licensing or others. So we can protect the institution. And if this content maybe is third party or purchased or licensed, then we can also enforce copyright on that existing content. And then it can be delivered through any of those course management systems directly. So a user that logs into Blackboard can do all of this through the native Blackboard interface. They don't even need to have to know our own interface. They can do it all through what they're already familiar with.
Well, that's pretty interesting. So the interface would be very familiar to somebody using Blackboard. Explain how they would add a simple content item to a Blackboard course.
Sure. So if I'm in Blackboard, then a couple of ways. One, if I'm running Blackboard's community system, then we are a building block. And so we actually show up as modules on that community system where you can search and contribute content. You can run our entire interface directly through that community system. Or if I go into a course that I have, you know, instructor's permissions, I go to add content the exact same way that I currently do with any other content type. And because we're a building block, you can drop down the list of content providers and you could choose a resource center object, and that would then sign that faculty member on into the repository directly. We take the user ID that they're signed into Blackboard with and we pass that directly to the repository. We log them in and we give them an interface that allows them to search the repository. And once they find what they're looking for, simply click an add button and that hands the absolute link and URL back to Blackboard. And then Blackboard takes over from there and contributes that into their course.
That sounds pretty powerful.
Well, we do the exact same thing in WebCT. So through a power link, it's the exact same experience for a WebCT user. It's exactly the same as using that native tool. It's a matter of how you use that tool currently, and then we just plug the repository into the back.
How about working with some of the open source content or course management systems?
So we have full integration with both Moodle and Sakai, and we can, in fact, again, be sharing across those platforms if you wanted to.
Your primary focus is on the educational community. Would this be also useful for general website content management?
It could be, but we are laser focused on sort of repository technology for education, K-12 and higher ed. There's probably a lot of the similar tools that you would expect in a CMS or a course or a content management system for powering web, but it's simply not what we do. It's not our core business, and so some institutions are doing that. Every item within the repository has its own persistent URL. But we're very careful and we want to say that it's not what we do, it's not our core business, but some of our clients are actually doing
it. One of the issues we hear a lot about is just putting up content once and have it be shared in several places, both, let's say, within the Blackboard portal or within a course, but it may be content that's also should be accessible to the general public, say through the institution's internet website. Is that something that's doable with your system?
Certainly. And so when you're creating the content links from your institutional website, you can literally just drop the URL directly into that website and then link directly into the content. We have a number of sort of permissions models that will allow you to do this without having to force users to log into the site as well. For instance, we can set an item in the repository as You can link to it, but you cannot discover it. In other words, you could search and never find that item in our repository, but the link will still actually link in and find that content directly.
Ah, okay.
And one of the concepts that we are really pushing in our technology is that we truly believe that content is a platform in a sense. And so when you describe, you know, can we make a content available to your corporate website and others, we firmly believe that course management systems are one delivery vehicle. But we have also an entire integration layer that means you can integrate our technologies into pretty much any platform. And so, you know, we're looking at for partnerships and talking actively to vendors in the space of synchronous tools, authoring tools, library technologies. We want an institution to be able to reach into the repository both to contribute search and use that content from any delivery mechanism down the road.
I see. You mentioned SCORM as one of the standards that you support. Can you explain what SCORM does for one?
Sure. So when we start to think about content as really learning objects and the idea that let's take a learning object from the sense of it has content, it has navigation, interactivity, potentially assessments or outcomes, and we want to package that up so that the user experience is consistent, so that if I run a SCORM object on our platform, I run it from Blackboard's platform, from any others, when the user loads that content, they should have the consistent navigation, consistent flow. They can enforce whether I want to go through that content in a linear fashion or not. And assessment outcome details should be pushed back to the gradebook of Blackboard or wherever else so that it is its own self-contained content unit. Now, we've done integrations with systems like Blackboard, for instance, because their APIs are pretty robust. So we've done integrations where, in fact, if you launch a SCORM content from our repository, we will actually pass the results back to the Blackboard gradebook through their APIs so that from a user's experience, it's consistent. It doesn't feel like I've launched out to any external site.
I see. When you mentioned sort of enforcing a common navigation, is this something adjustable or customizable at the client's end? Does it use something like style sheets, or how does that work?
Well, if you're using standard SCORM, then we could certainly enforce the SCORM sequencing, because depending on how you've packaged the SCORM together. Now, we don't necessarily need SCORM to handle that packaging and that navigation. We actually can create structured learning objects within our repository as well. So we actually allow clients to build what we call structured content, and that means that I can go into the repository and I can take, you know, this learning object, this video, this presentation, this piece of content, and put them together in a structured navigation flow and then restore that into the repository as well. So we have the ability to do a lot of this packaging, and so that's why we also support content packaging like IMS and others to make sure that we can repurpose and reuse the objects that are in the repository as well.
Now, when a faculty tags content, is it a free-form tagging, or is it forced into some vocabulary?
All of the above. And so these contribution wizards that we talked about earlier, the administrators of the site will actually create these contribution wizards. So we want it to be sort of context relevant to who you are. If you're a faculty member in the School of Accounting and you want to contribute a journal or a periodical, then the contribution wizard will actually ask you relevant questions like, you know, the publication details of the journal and what's the profession and accounting terms that are using. So we can allow them to fill in text boxes, radio buttons, drop-down lists, shuffle lists, or launch into what we again call sort of taxonomy browsers where they could just click and select the terms that they would want to use, including things like ERIC and GEM, some of the sort of standard taxonomies in the industry as well.
Now, my audience has been hearing a lot lately about Web 2.0 technology, and when I think of that, I think of web applications. You know, Google has pioneered some of that, and they look very much like applications rather than a web page. Blackboard, for example, is pretty much non-Web 2.0. Do you use some of that newer technology?
It's interesting when you say newer, because when you think about Web 2.0, some of the technologies underneath that are powering that are web services model. Our technology has been around since 2002 and was built on this web service architecture, and it's evolved over the years. And so, yes, we have a native interface, we have a standard browser, but we also enable through our development interfaces, applications to literally reach in, write, and read, and control the content within the repository directly from their application. One of the first examples of that is we have a built-in authoring tool that's in what we call an assembly tool, because most people don't necessarily completely author, but they want to reassemble content from existing repository objects. So we have an authoring tool that's actually written in Java. It runs on its own. There's no installer. And it uses those web services APIs to both read and write back to the repository to actually manage that content. So we've built it on, you know, Java J2E technologies, but it's also been built through a SOAP interface and an extensible architecture to allow people to plug in and sort of read and write and consume the content.
Okay. I certainly will have a link to your website on my show notes for my podcast. I think some of this is hard to visualize until you can actually see what it looks like. Are there any demos that you have on your site?
Demos are hard because it's very, very configurable. But what I can do is a lot of our clients have guest access turned on to the repositories. And so I'm happy to send you links to some of our client sites that are already doing this. In three particular examples, we can send you a guest access account to the Florida Distance Learning Consortium and the Orange Grove Project. We can send you a guest account to the Georgia Border Regents University systems there. And another one that's very interesting in how they're taking the same approach is an organization called BC Campus in Western Canada that, again, has a repository available to all of the higher ed institutions in the province of British Columbia. So I'll make sure that you have links to all of those sites that you can get into, and your people that are listening to the podcast can certainly go and check out those repositories as well.
That'd be great. Just as on the technical end, from an IT perspective, is this something that school would host themselves, or do you offer hosting?
We do both, and so it's a local install if you'd like it to, or we have hosting partners in the U.S. that can certainly do hosting for us on a full service and full scale.
I see. How many, just out of curiosity, how many clients do you have now using Aquila?
We have about 60 clients worldwide, and in North America, we're up to, I think, 12 or 13 clients in North America directly. And that sounds like a low number, except that some of those clients are very, very large, depending on the statewide initiatives. And one of the things that I'd love to continue to have conversations with you around is we are really passionate about how can we enable content sharing in a sort of secure way across, you know, multiple states, multiple countries. And so we actually have the ability to do, you know, things like metadata harvesting and federated searching to enable content sharing on a large scale or a small scale. And so I certainly ask the people that are members of your podcast community if they can work with us to find areas where we can bring up some of these repositories and enable sharing. And we're working with organizations that can certainly enable that as well.
Ah, very interesting. Sure. Well, listen, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I learned a lot about Aquila and what you're doing. Are any other thoughts you'd like to leave my audience with? Anything that's coming down the pike in new releases? Anything else you want to mention?
Yeah, there's a couple of things. We have a new release probably in the next 2 or 3 weeks, and the main focus of that new release is this development environment where we can enable clients, partners to really plug technologies in, and we're talking about creating their own custom controls and a number of other things. So we're very excited to start to generate and create that community so that people can develop and share applications. We're doing a lot of work around this idea of sharing, you know, large-scale images and imaging databases and others, and so we're looking to sort of build our advisory capacity in the space and see, you know, really tell us what you're thinking, what we can do to build some of the technology to do some of the things that you would like to do.
Great. Well, listen, thanks a lot. Start looking for our interview on my podcast.
Perfect. I appreciate it. It's always great to catch up.
All right. Thanks a lot, Peter.
Take care.
Well, I think that's all we have time for today. So stay tuned and hear the full song, Something About Eve by Falling You, some ethereal, ambient, new age music from Magnatune. Until next time, have a great week.
Please leave odd feedback at 610-616-2199. And dark.
That's it for today's episode. Thank you very much for listening. Please don't forget to leave Rod feedback. You can go to www.rodspulsepodcast.com and leave comments on his blog. You can send feedback to his email address, rod@rodspulsepodcast.com. You can also send audio feedback by calling into his comment line at 610-616-2199. Till next time, have a great week.
The preceding audio commentary is the product of the author, Dr. Rod Numeri, and does not represent the official viewpoint of Thomas Jefferson University, or any other institution or company.